Welcome to Follicular Lymphoma Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Nathan Fowler from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, who presented the Phase 3 Relevance Trial looking at the so-called R-squared regimen of lenalidomide and rituximab as upfront treatment of FL. And to begin, I asked Dr. Fowler to review the history of evolution of clinical research and upfront therapy of FL.
You know, for goodness, probably two or three decades, probably 40 plus years, we've been hitting low-grade lymphomas with different types of cytotoxic chemotherapy drugs. And, you know, if you look at the progression of treatment all the way up until probably the mid-2000s, it really evolved with using multiple different non-cross-resistant type of therapy, just like every other cancer, right? Initially start with Cytoxan and maybe some chlorambucil, and then we started adding fludarabine. In the 90s and early 2000s at MD Anderson, we were looking at regimens like alternating triple therapy, which is really aggressive chemotherapy, with follicular lymphoma and other low-grade lymphomas. And the hope was that with using these different combination chemotherapies, we could eradicate the follicular lymphoma clone completely. Unfortunately, although we probably did cure a percentage of patients, a lot of those approaches were associated with a lot of toxicity, right? We had several patients that unfortunately developed myelodysplasia later on down the line, as well as some patients that had pretty significant infections during the treatment. So, you know, again, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we started looking at alternate ways to target these follicular lymphoma cells. Now, I think all of us know about rituximab, which is really a wonderful drug. I always think it's funny when we think about immunotherapy now as a brand new concept when, you know, rituximab was approved 20-odd years ago, and it's one of the first immunotherapies. It targets a very unique aspect of the B cell, and that's this CD20 on the cell surface. So it's really, lymphoma and leukemias are really a wonderful example of finding a unique target that's not on other types of cells, right? CD20 is not on the heart or the liver or the kidneys, and using that unique target to develop a therapy that can basically seek out and find those malignant cells. Now, CD20 is in non-malignant B cells, but usually at a lower level.
So just to clarify, you know, pretty basic question, but, you know, important one, which is when you refer to rituximab or anti-CD20 therapy as immunotherapy, what do you envision actually happens in your own mind once, you know, that antigen is attacked?
Yeah, sure. So what we think happens, and it's a great question, Neil, you know, we're still learning 20-odd years later exactly how rituximab works, and it probably works a little bit differently in different types of cancers. So the kind of three main mechanisms of rituximab would be, you know, binding to the cell surface and activating these downstream signaling cascades and leading to direct cell death. That's probably a minor effect of the way rituximab works, at least in follicular. It also activates complement, which I think probably is also not a major effect. But the main way, or the main mechanism that it kills cancer cells, is it binds to the cell surface, and then your immune system recognizes this antigen-antibody complex, and there is recruitment or activation of NK cells and T cells within the microenvironment, which then release lysozymes and effectively kill the malignant cell. And one of the difficulties with rituximab as a single agent is if you look at the response rate in patients, for example, with newly diagnosed disease, it's about 50 to 70%. And so although the proof of principle is there, it doesn't work in everybody and it doesn't lead to cure. And so there are clearly some of these cells that have the target that are able to evade rituximab, evade this immune response. And so what we've been trying to do as a field and at Anderson over the last, you know, again, 10, 15 years, is try to boost the effect of rituximab. And we had some early trials where we looked at combining rituximab with interferon, combining rituximab with leukine. And again, this whole idea was that we think we know what's happening in the microenvironment. Is there a way that we can either augment the antibody or augment the immune response to increase these responses we saw with rituximab?
Before you go on, as long as we're going to go through this whole mechanism thing, which I think is really awesome, can you talk a little bit about other anti-CD20 agents, particularly obinutuzumab? I mean, there is a suggestion that maybe it works better or it does work better, but what's the biology of it?
Yeah, so obinutuzumab, as you mentioned, it's another anti-CD20, and it binds to a slightly different epitope on the cell surface. So it also binds to CD20 like rituximab, but it's a slightly different site on the CD20. It also is what we call glycosylated, and this allows what we think to happen is it has this kind of flexible Fc elbow, and through glycosylation allows it bind tighter to NK cells. So in essence, what it does, when it binds to a little bit different epitope, maybe it can overcome some of the resistance mechanisms of rituximab, but also recruits NK cells and T cells a little bit better than rituximab. And we've seen this in preclinical models. If you compare obinutuzumab and rituximab, obinutuzumab does have greater recruitment of these immune cells and can work in preclinical models that are rituximab resistant.
So you were going to go on and talk about, I guess, other non-chemotherapy approaches, and you talked about the microenvironment. How about IMIDs and lenalidomide?
Yeah, so again, kind of going on this whole theme, we started to look at lots of different kind of non-chemo approaches over the last 10 or 15 years, and I'm sure we kind of will go in and talk about some of the targeted drugs. It turns out that when we first were using lenalidomide as an anti-cancer drug in things like myeloma, we knew it had some direct cell death, and we thought that maybe it was changing vasculature within the microenvironment. And there were some early models in, I guess, probably the mid-2000s that suggested that lenalidomide could also boost NK cells. There were trials that were led from folks at the Mayo Clinic where they used lenalidomide as a single agent in follicular lymphoma. And unfortunately, response rate's not that great, around 20% response rate if you use lenalidomide as a single agent in low-grade lymphomas. But we had this idea that if it truly does boost NK cell activity, then maybe this would be a good drug to combine with rituximab. And that was the premise of the early trials where we combined rituximab with lenalidomide in low-grade lymphomas. It was not so much to use lenalidomide as an anti-cancer drug, but mainly to boost the effect of rituximab through increasing ADCC.
You mentioned myeloma, and I know Keith Stewart and there are other myeloma people were looking into. I'm trying to think of the name of the intermediary for the IMIDs.
Yeah, so Cereblon.
Cereblon, right, Cereblon. So does that have anything to do with lymphomas?
So it turns out that Cereblon is actually, it's a part of this protein degradation complex, this E3 ubiquitin ligase complex that helps control the level of different substrates in almost every cell in the body. So Cereblon's in low-grade lymphomas. It's also in pretty much every cancer. We're still kind of understanding, you know, how it controls different substrates and different malignancies. And in other words, it probably acts a little differently in every cancer. Keith Stewart and others have shown that levels of Cereblon in myeloma correlate with the likelihood of response to lenalidomide. We have not done those same kind of studies in low-grade lymphomas, but the, you know, I imagine that, again, knowing that that's the target of lenalidomide, it would make sense that there probably is different levels of Cereblon or the activity of Cereblon in responders versus non-responders with low-grade lymphoma.
So just to finish out this sort of brief tour in terms of sort of pathways, the other one that's kind of filtering out into clinical practice is PI3 kinase. So how does that fit into the puzzle?
Sure. So we know that this B cell receptor that's active in pretty much all B cells, including malignant B cells, is pretty critical to the function of, again, not only normal B cells, but a lot of the malignant B cells. And so targeting this B cell receptor pathway with drugs like PI3 kinase inhibitors, which is a part of the B cell receptor pathway, BTK inhibitors, SYK inhibitors, makes sense if you want to shut down these malignant B cells. And so we've looked at these drugs, again, BTK inhibitors and PI3 kinase inhibitors, in lots of different B cell cancers. Turns out that PI3 kinase inhibitors or inhibiting the PI3 kinase delta isoform in low-grade lymphomas is a pretty good approach. If you target, again, this part of the B cell receptor pathway, the PI3 kinase isoform, in low-grade lymphomas with drugs like adalimumab, copanlisib, and others, we're seeing responses of up almost around 60 to 70% in folks with refractory disease. And this drug is fairly specific for an isoform of PI3 kinase that's mainly seen in hematologic cells. And why that's relevant, and you know, there is limited off-target effect with a lot of these drugs. Although there is some, but it doesn't affect all organs. Definitely not as broad as, for example, traditional chemotherapy.
So you mentioned BTK inhibitors, and you know, you don't hear too much about that, or particularly ibrutinib and FL, but I mean, it has been looked at. I think there's some activity, but it kind of doesn't seem like it's a major player here. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's been a little disappointing. I was lucky to do a lot of the early phase ones with ibrutinib and lots of different malignancies, and although my focus is low-grade lymphoma, unfortunately, that's the one histology where we haven't seen a ton of activity. As a single agent, the BTK inhibitors are around 20% response rate in relapse disease. So definitely we don't see the kind of excitement that we see in, for example, mantle cell lymphoma and Waldenstrom's CLL in the low-grade lymphomas.
Any idea why it's not as active as in some of these others?
The current thought is that there's probably less dependence on an activated B-cell receptor pathway in low-grade lymphoma compared to CLL and mantle cell lymphoma.
So I feel this interview, in a way, is kind of the culmination of a long process that you just began describing that started with biology, and now we're going to track how it led into just recently you're presenting the data at ASCO on the relevance study. But before I do, I've got to ask you, I was just flashing on the fact, because this whole idea of, you know, as you're talking about the sort of non-chemotherapy approach to follicular lymphoma, I just interviewed Bruce Chesson. You were a fellow with him, right?
Yes, I was, yeah.
Wasn't that kind of part of how this all got started?
So he and I worked on some of the very early lenalidomide trials for CLL. And actually, we wrote a study to do fludarabine followed by lenalidomide in relapsed CLL. And then when I came to Anderson, I stopped doing CLL and moved to follicular. And so around that time, this was, goodness, about 10 years ago, when I was a first-year faculty, I finished writing out the very first pilot trial to do lenalidomide and rituximab in follicular. But yeah, I definitely, some of the very early work was co-writing these trials in CLL with Bruce when I was at Georgetown.
Maybe you could talk a little bit briefly about, you know, the early studies, single arm studies, et cetera, that kind of led into the relevant study.
So I guess probably 2008, 2009, I'll go back even further. In the mid-2000s, there were some studies looking at lenalidomide led by Tom Witzig and others as a single agent in relapsed follicular. And the response rates, albeit it had activity, were not that fantastic. Actually, kind of similar to what we see with ibrutinib, around 20% response rate. So there was not a lot of movement with lenalidomide, at least in the lymphoma side of things. Some studies going on in CLL. And probably 2009, we wrote this investigator-initiated trial. It was probably a little bit, I like to joke about being in Texas, there was a little bit of a cowboy approach. There was no data in the relapse setting. There was some phase one data in mantle cell lymphoma. But we went straight to the front line and wrote a little study with 30 patients to do lenalidomide rituximab for newly diagnosed follicular and SLL and marginal. And I think when we had the first 14 or so patients, we had 100% CR rate. Now, it didn't quite pan out to be that high as we continue to enroll, but I remember, you know, with literally having a little bit over a dozen patients, and we went to our sponsor and said, you know, we got this regimen. It looks very, very interesting in follicular. And they gave us enough funding to expand the study from 30 patients up to 155 patients. And as we continue to enroll patients, we saw that follicular lymphoma response rate held pretty high. We were hitting CR rates between 80 and 90%. As we began to present this data, CLGB also was running a trial with very similar regimen. And they also showed complete remission rates, you know, close to around 80% in relapsed follicular. And so that was really the start of this, you know, R-squared and follicular lymphoma, these two frontline trials, before we actually even had a lot of relapse data. And with these two independent trials showing responses very similar in follicular, a group of investigators, myself and some folks in France, wrote this phase three trial to compare lenalidomide rituximab versus R-chemo. And yeah, that was the start of this relevance trial. By the way, some people don't know that relevance meant lenalidomide versus any chemotherapy. And we were trying to basically design a regimen that would take the standard of care, which would be rituximab bendamustine, rituximab CVP, or rituximab plus CHOP, and compare it to a single regimen that would be R-squared. And we ended up, you know, enrolling and presenting that data at this last ASCO. Actually, it came out in New England Journal.
Can you go through the regimen, particularly the whole issue of maintenance, and then how that compares in terms of what the control arm, I guess mainly BR, but also what the entire platform was, including the maintenance?
Sure, sure. So both arms, and you got to kind of remember when this study was being designed, which was around 10 years ago now, the PRIMA trial had just read out. And so in the PRIMA trial, I'll remind folks, had basically R chemo followed by R maintenance. And so when we designed that trial, there was a lot of buzz about maintenance. I think maintenance is still a good option, but we really wanted to have maintenance in both arms to mirror what was at that time felt to be the standard of care for all patients newly diagnosed. So as you mentioned, both arms had maintenance therapy where everyone had rituximab for 2 years after finishing induction therapy, both arms. In the experimental arm, which is the lenalidomide arm, we started patients with 20 milligrams of lenalidomide given on days 1 through 21 of a 28-day cycle, with rituximab given at the beginning of each cycle. The first cycle, they had kind of a weekly induction regimen. At 6 cycles, they were evaluated, and if they were not in a complete remission, they could continue on with 20 milligrams of lenalidomide for up to 12 cycles. If they were in remission, then we did this drop-down dose where they got 10 milligrams of lenalidomide for another 12 months. So the total dose, it's a little bit complicated. The total dose of lenalidomide, or sorry, the total duration of lenalidomide was 18 months. 6 months of induction followed by a kind of a maintenance additional 12 months at 10 milligrams of lenalidomide. And this was to hopefully decrease the rates of neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. So both arms had rituximab for 2 years. The lenalidomide arm had a kind of a extended duration of about 12 months of 10 milligrams of lenalidomide after the 6 months induction. On the chemo arms, basically the investigator could choose between rituximab bendamustine, rituximab CHOP, or rituximab plus CVP. They all got 6 cycles, and at the end of 6 cycles, they then got another 2 years of maintenance rituximab given every 2 months per the PRIMA trial.
So we'll talk about the results of the study and what they might mean, but in terms of if someone wanted to then sort of translate this trial into their own practice, do you think it is advisable or necessary to sort of reduplicate that regimen? Because as you say, there's been a lot of back and forth about maintenance. We can talk about that as a separate issue. I got to say that I don't remember exactly how he said it was going to do it, but when I interviewed Bruce, he said, oh yeah, I give it for a year and that's it. And I'm like, you know, I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly how he balances the len and rituximab, but do you think it would be reasonable to use, let's say, a shorter version of what was actually used in the trial?
Yeah, I think that it's hard to know. I mean, I can tell you that in our study, our initial phase 2 trial at MD Anderson, we did 6 months. Pretty much almost all the patients, with the exception of a few that were not in remission, only got 6 months of lenalidomide rituximab. And right now, with those 6 months of therapy, we have a progression-free survival at 3 years of almost 70%. That's pretty decent. In the CLGB trial, they did 12 months of lenalidomide, which is why Bruce is probably saying 12 months. This is how their cooperative group did it. With the relevance trial, we had 18 months of lenalidomide. So it's like with a lot of trials, you know, we're comparing a cross trial, our trial mainly 6 months, CLGB 12 months, and then you have this relevance trial where they had 18 months total. To me, the results all look kind of similar. And what I would recommend if I was doing this in practice, I do think that I would probably try to get patients to 12 months. However, in my own practice, if, for example, patients develop toxicity, I'll tell them, let's just try to get to 6 months. If they start to become cytopenic, they do infections, I would stop at 6 months.
What about the rituximab?
So with rituximab maintenance, in patients who achieve a complete remission and are young and otherwise healthy, I actually don't do maintenance in the majority of my patients. I think that many times patients can get rituximab at relapse. There has never been a maintenance trial that has shown a benefit in overall survival with adding maintenance therapy, and there's additional cost. The patients that I do maintenance on are usually patients who are only in a partial remission, patients who are at high risk for relapse, so patients with very high FLIPI scores, maybe bulky disease, and older patients who I think won't tolerate a second round of chemotherapy. So, for example, I've had an 80-year-old patient, and not that 80 is necessarily old, but in patients who have comorbid conditions, and I know this is my one chance to get a durable remission, then I think progression-free survival is really meaningful because if they relapse, I'm maybe limited on my options. So those are the kind of the three scenarios when I do maintenance. But in a patient who has a great response to induction, they're otherwise young and healthy, I often will defer and see how they do.
But just to clarify, so again, outside a trial setting, if you're going to use R-squared up front, you would give both the lenalidomide and rituximab for 1 year?
Yeah, I would say 6 to 12 months. And again, the reason I'm hedging a little bit, 6 to 12, it would depend on the response.
So in other words, do you kind of like give them both and that's it, or do you give rituximab by itself after?
I usually don't. I don't rituximab after. Usually I do both. Again, the only folks that I would give them a tail of maintenance single agent rituximab are, for example, patients that only got a PR.
Okay, so I'm going to get into the data and what was found in this study. But one other thing I just wanted to sort of put out there before we get into that, which is something I've kind of been thinking about, is the issue of adherence. and specifically adherence to a longer-term oral anti-cancer therapy, in this case, lenalidomide. And, of course, that issue's been out there with myeloma because they give lenalidomide, you know, forever in that situation. But there are other drugs now, novel agents that are being given. Sort of CML was an example, obviously. PARP inhibitors, endocrine and CDK inhibitors in breast cancer. Any thoughts or any data about adherence to longer-term lenalidomide in follicular lymphoma? To what extent, if any, is it an issue?
One of the problems with follicular lymphoma is that you've got a disease that in many patients, probably the majority of patients, the disease will not take their life. And so this is very relevant, right? When you're talking about extended duration of therapy and side effects, even minor side effects, there's a lot less, the threshold for continuing on drug is much less than, for example, lung cancer, breast cancer, myeloma, where if the disease progresses, they're at significant risk. So I think that when you look at longer duration of therapies, and I think really when I think about that, I think more about the PI3 kinase inhibitors, BTK inhibitors than lenalidomide, because at least with lenalidomide, we have a fixed duration. Even if it could be 18 months in some patients, the end is in sight, right? And so you can often kind of get patients through that with dose adjustments, with potentially dose interruptions if they have a rash or diarrhea. And I think it's much easier to keep patients compliant when you have some end in sight. And we're seeing this now again with CLL and some of the other trials where they're looking at fixed duration of therapy. But with me, I haven't had a lot of issues with compliance with lenalidomide. And again, mainly because I really focus on the total duration of therapy with the patient. I tell them, okay, we're only going to go to 6 months or 12 months or 18 months. And I let them know that this is going to be response adapted. So if they have a great response, we could potentially stop early, or if they have a toxicity, we'll stop before 18 months.
So I want to get a little bit into the issue of toxicity after we talk about the data. It's interesting. We had a working group of general oncologists in here in our studio for a video where we asked them for questions they had about different diseases, and one was FL, and one of the docs said, well, you know, I went to a BESTA ASCO course, and they said the relevance trial was negative.
Oh, right.
And they're not using R-squared. But, you know, when I looked at the paper, it looks like it's the same as the R-chemotherapy. So, you know, it kind of gets into the way it was set up. But the bottom line is it's kind of hard to look at that trial and see a difference between R-squared and R-chemo. Is that kind of everybody's take on that?
So I love Bruce's comment on this. And he said that it's the most positive negative trial that we've seen at ASCO. And it's a great way to talk about it because the trial, unfortunately, was designed as a superiority trial. And it was not designed to look at these two regimens for non-inferiority. But, I mean, you don't have to be an oncologist or an academic to look at the two graphs. I mean, they are literally overlapping. The progression-free survival was pretty much identical between R-squared and R-chemo. At 3 years, it was 77 versus 78%. And the toxicity profile is less. So I think about this as, you know, we see less neutropenia, less infections, less nausea, vomiting, no hair loss with R-squared compared to R-chemo, and you get exactly the same outcome. So what I think about is, for most patients, you've got a regimen that is probably a little more tolerable and will lead to very similar outcomes. So I think that at least this is another option for patients to discuss when you're thinking about frontline therapy.
The thing that really surprised me is, I mean, first of all, I would imagine you were not surprised. I mean, maybe you might have been hoping it might have been better, but I don't think you were thinking it'd be worse, right?
Correct. You know, one of the issues with these trials, and I think this is with a lot of trials, is we're trying to get these drugs to market and get them in the hands of patients quickly. So this trial was designed before we really had durable progression-free survival data from these first phase two trials. And if you look at the progression-free survival, now that we have longer follow-up for both these phase two trials, it looks very similar to what we see in relevance. It's almost the same, around 70% at 3 years. And so in retrospect, the outcomes are pretty much what we saw from the original trials, but we didn't have that data. All we really had was response data when we were designing these trials. We did a little look at our own patients at MD Anderson about 2 years ago, published this in the Annals of Oncology, looking at our outcomes of patients with BR, R-CHOP, and R-squared. And guess what we saw? Almost identical PFS. So again, when we look at our own patients, this is kind of what we see in practice, is that all three of these regimens look pretty comparable.
And remind me, is lenalidomide approved in follicular lymphoma?
It is not.
Not even in relapse disease?
Not in relapse. There is a study ongoing that John Leonard and some folks are leading where it's called the AUGMENT trial. And this is R-squared versus rituximab in relapsed follicular. This could potentially lead to FDA registration for lenalidomide in the relapse setting.
So what are the practicalities right now of obtaining R-squared if you want to use it up front?
So the good news is that based upon the phase 2 data and some relapse data, that it is on the NCCN guidelines for both untreated as well as relapsed patients. So it's hard for me to talk about what, for example, insurance companies will cover, but many insurance companies use the NCCN guidelines as a kind of guideline about what they'll approve. So in my own practice, I've been able to use lenalidomide in the frontline and in the relapse setting in follicular without too much difficulty.
And is R-squared or lenalidomide in front of the FDA up front? Is it being submitted?
With the current trial, no, because again, we had discussed without getting a lot of information, but you know, this trial was potentially going to go to registration, but did not meet the primary endpoint. Sorry, I should mention there were two primary endpoints in the trial. One was called CR30. This is patients that had a complete remission at 30 months on therapy. And we had talked to the FDA, and this is a surrogate for progression-free survival. That endpoint was not met. We have not yet reached PFS in both arms. So we don't yet know if PFS will be better with R-squared. If that does get a positive PFS, we could go to the FDA with the trial. But that's going to take a couple more years of follow-up to hit median PFS in both arms.
So the thing that really surprised me, and it's always so fascinating, you know, doing CME in all parts of oncology, how people respond to new data and sort of the philosophies. And I was actually reflecting back on when BR came in, you know, like everybody resisted that. They couldn't believe it was better than R. It took a couple years to even change. But I've got to say, I've been surprised in talking to investigators, you know, since ASCO, that there's, and even docs in practice, that there's not a wholesale jumping on it. And what I'm hearing people say is, I mean, obviously, if you're going to use it, the idea would be less toxicity. And what I'm hearing people say is, well, BR is not that bad and not that much advantage. And that kind of surprised me. Is that the case? Is that what you believe?
No. I think it goes back to, this is really a kind of revolutionary idea that we can move away from chemotherapy. And people that have been using chemotherapy their whole careers, you know, it's this not doing chemotherapy for a lymphoma that responds to chemotherapy. It's a bit of a radical idea. And I think that, you know, we saw, for example, with CHOP moved to bendamustine, you have another alkylator, right? It's a different class of alkylator, but this is, you're still using a drug that you're comfortable with. And I think that it's hard to get folks to switch from something they're very used to giving. They're used to the toxicity profile. If you talk to my patients and ask them how they feel about chemotherapy versus lenalidomide or non-chemo, there's no question. I mean, you may ask, talk to many oncologists who say bendamustine or R-CHOP's not that bad. But I would talk to the patient. I've had many of my patients who are on lenalidomide go into complete remission and literally come into my office and tell me I'm guilty. I'm sitting in the waiting room and I see these other patients that have no hair or they're wearing masks and my patients are doing great. I actually have a young guy who is at a local college and he was a infielder for a top college team, continued the whole season and went into a complete remission on lenalidomide rituximab. So he was playing a very competitive sport. I can almost guarantee you he would not have been able to have done that in bendamustine or R-CHOP. So the patients that tolerate it well, tolerate it extremely well. And I have a real hard time thinking about, you know, exposing my patients to potentially very serious toxicities when I can get the same outcome with something that is much less toxic.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this evolves. Let's talk a little bit, though, about some of the practicalities of using lenalidomide. Again, you know, we've been hearing about it so much for years in myeloma, but a couple of specific issues, cytopenias. Anything you want to say about the frequency of cytopenias and how easy or difficult they are to manage with dose modifications?
Sure. So neutropenia does occur, and although it's at a lower rate than what we see with chemotherapy, I don't want to minimize. You know, this is, I tell people, although this is not chemo, it doesn't mean it's non-toxic. There are some toxicities. As you mentioned, neutropenia is probably somewhere around 20 to 30%, although the infection rate was much lower. And I think that probably has somewhat to do with the mechanism of how lenalidomide affects neutrophils. It causes maturation arrest, And you don't see elimination of the whole neutrophil population like you see with chemo. Our febrile neutropenia rate was very, very low. The thrombocytopenia rate is also pretty low. In patients who develop neutropenia, I usually drop the dose by 5 milligrams. So when they start at 20, we drop to 15 milligrams. If they continue to have neutropenia, I drop it to 10 milligrams. And interestingly, if you look at our trials, I track the neutropenia rate over time. And even though they get more drug, neutropenia rate drops. So what we saw in the phase 2 trials, neutropenia rate tended to get highest around cycle 2, cycle 3. And as you modified the dose, by the time you got to cycle 6, neutropenia rate was down around 5 to 10%. So in other words, when you get patients on an optimal dose, the neutropenia rate and the thrombocytopenia rate really drop to very minimal levels.
So how about dermatologic issues?
Rash is probably the most troublesome side effect that we see with this drug. And rash occurs generally in the first cycle. It can occur in up to 50% of patients, although in most patients, when I say most, this is in the teens, it's grade 3. And again, when we talk about rash, I'll remind people, grade has to do with how much of the body surface it covers. So grade 3 means it's over more than 50% of the body surface. Most patients, this rash is not painful, it's not blistering, it's a little bit of a nuisance. And in most patients, it goes away after the first cycle. We treat it with Claritin, actually. Antihistamines tend to work quite well with the rash. And I think this kind of goes back to it's probably an immunologic response. And again, most of these patients, the rash does not recur. But in a very small minority, they had to stop drug. In fact, in the relevance trial, only 2% of patients had to stop drug due to rash. So quite rare.
Interesting. How about diarrhea?
It's a funny thing. Well, not funny, haha, but interesting thing. Patients can have GI side effects, and it alternates between constipation or diarrhea. And this probably has, I think we're kind of not quite sure why this happens, but it does not really too much cramping or pain, but patients can alternate between loose stools as well as constipation. I usually treat them with over-the-counter Imodium or other anti-motility agents if they get diarrhea.
We've heard about, I think it's cholestipol, the anti-bile salt agent from the myeloma people related to diarrhea, lenalidomide. Any experience with that?
Yeah, I think it works pretty well. I mean, sometimes, again, it depends on the level of diarrhea. Many of my patients will have very mild loose stools, and sometimes just adding a little bit extra fiber or something like Imodium, it will get better. Again, it's given 21 days on, 7 days off. And so many times on those 7 days off, it recovers. In other words, it doesn't begin to occur until about a week on drug, and it recovers on the week off. So it's about 5 or 6 days when they have diarrhea that's symptomatic. And many times, we don't even have to go to bile salts.
Just out of curiosity, what's your second-line therapy in a patient who has R-squared up front?
BR, bendamustine rituximab. Yeah. Well, I should mention, sorry, it depends on the length of remission. So if patients get lenalidomide rituximab and they get 5 or 6 years and they have a fairly low volume relapse, actually, I'll just do rituximab alone or obinutuzumab as a single agent. But if they relapse with bulky disease or symptomatic, usually bendamustine.
We were talking about obinutuzumab before. Where are we at looking at lenalidomide obinutuzumab? I don't know if there's a short name for that.
Not yet. I'm sure we'll come up with something.
Not like R-squared, huh?
So we have ongoing studies both in the relapsed and the frontline with lenalidomide obinutuzumab. We're doing these at MD Anderson. And I think we now have around 57 out of our 60 patients enrolled in the relapse setting. And I hope, hopefully, be able to present this at the coming ASCO, lenalidomide obinutuzumab. We also have a frontline trial that's enrolling patients. And again, hopefully this is kind of the next generation using a little bit better antibody.
I guess you wouldn't see phase 3 R-squared versus obinutuzumab lenalidomide, would you?
Somebody might do it. It probably won't be me. Although you never know. Maybe you and I'll be talking here 20 years later.
Let's go through some of your cases. We'll make some quick rounds on some patients that you've taken care of. Beginning actually with a 52-year-old woman who got R-squared. What happened with her?
This is a great case, and this is a woman that actually referred to me from an acquaintance. A very healthy woman, skis often, is very, very active, no other comorbid conditions, and she actually came in very symptomatic. She had bilateral pleural effusions, shortness of breath, had some nodes within the mediastinum, which were enlarged. We did PET imaging, which showed that the nodes above and below diaphragm, but all the SUVs, this is important, SUVs were all pretty low, around 5 or 6, so really no evidence of any active transformation. She had a biopsy of one of these nodes in the chest and showed a grade 1-2 follicular. And she came in, and we talked to her kind of about all the different options, And she was really very, very nervous about chemotherapy. I think she had a sister that had gone through chemotherapy of breast cancer and was really looking for some non-chemo type approach. And I went through this with her. And again, I think despite my bias, I always try to offer patients lots of different options. And we decided to do lenalidomide and rituximab, and she went into a complete remission. It took about 2 months for the pleural effusions to improve. And I stopped with 6 cycles to one of your earlier questions with her. And she's over a year out now and still in a complete remission and kind of comes to see me about every 3 months.
So any tolerability issues with the R-squared?
She had a little bit of mild fatigue, but really no issues with neutropenia, maybe a little bit of loose stools if I remember, but really she did very well.
It's funny, I was just flashing an interview I did with Jeff Sharman, I think it was about 5 years ago, and some woman in the Northwest absolutely would not take chemo, gives her R-squared, just like your patient goes into complete remission. And I remember hearing about that case thinking, why isn't everybody getting this? And now it's a few years later, but we'll see what happens with that. Let's talk a little bit about relapse disease, and maybe to get into that, we can hear about your 53-year-old lady.
She had been diagnosed really quite a long time ago, and she had had lots of different treatments. She had, initially, before I saw her, she had been treated with R-CHOP and then had a relapse, actually fairly early, but I think it was around a year and a half later. She then got bendamustine rituximab. We gave her lenalidomide and rituximab at the time, and then she had progression actually pretty soon after lenalidomide and rituximab. And so that time, I was starting to look at options. You know, I was talking to her about potentially autologous stem cell transplant. She was really not that keen on doing a transplant. We actually were looking for donors, and she had a brother who was actually a very good match for an allogeneic transplant. And we decided to give her idelalisib as a single agent. And she tolerated this very well. Actually didn't have any diarrhea or any colitis, no GI issues. And when she relapsed, she actually had some pretty bulky, visible nodes in the neck. Those all disappeared with idelalisib, but with the CT PET scans, it didn't go away completely. She still had some residual nodes at around 2 centimeters in the chest and abdomen. And I think she stayed on this for almost a year, if I remember. Yeah, so 14 months, but then progressed. And this was a couple years ago. And we sent her to the NIH at that time for a CAR T-cell trial. And she got on the CAR Ts and, again, had a very nice initial response but had a lot of neurotoxicity within the first, goodness, I guess it was probably within about a month of therapy. Came to see me soon thereafter. She had a good partial remission. I put her on observation because her symptoms had resolved. And within, I would say, 6 months, she again progressed with nodes in the neck and in the abdomen. So, you know, there was some idea about, again, this maybe we could re-energize the CAR T cells with immunotherapy, and I put her back on single agent lenalidomide without rituximab, and she went into a complete remission.
Wow.
Fantastic, yeah. And she had progressed with lenalidomide almost immediately after lenalidomide before, so I think that we're probably boosting the CAR T cells that were still circulating in her, and this is when 3 or 4 months after the CAR T cell at NIH.
Wow.
Yeah, fantastic.
Now what? What's going on with her now?
So actually she went on. We talked about this for a while, and I was not so sure if this would be durable. So remember I mentioned she had a brother that was a match, and so we sent her, and she had an allogeneic transplant.
Wow.
And is now in follow-up.
What a story.
Whether or not, and, you know, in retrospect, I'm thinking about it, did she really need an allo transplant? It's going to be hard to know. We're seeing this at that time. This was a couple years ago before we had much durable data with the CAR T-cell therapy, but...
Wow, what a story.
We actually are writing, you know, we wrote her case up with a couple other cases of CAR T-cells that kind of re-energized with either PD-1 inhibitors or lenalidomide.
Wow, that is really fascinating. So I don't know where to begin, but just briefly, where are we with CAR T and follicular today?
Sure. Steve Schuster and the group at Penn, they published a New England Journal article with CAR T-cell and relapsed lymphomas, but they also, and some people I think may have, don't read all the way through the article, they actually had some follicular lymphoma patients in there. And I think, I want to say they had around 14 patients with follicular lymphoma. And in those patients, around, I want to say it was around 60 or 70% of those patients went into a complete remission. And I think if I remember right from the paper, they're still in a complete remission. That's pretty good, actually. That's a higher CR rate than we see with large cell lymphomas. Now, there are a couple CAR T-cell trials which are ongoing. One of those is with the Yescarta drug in relapsed follicular. We have that study open at Anderson where we're looking at patients who relapse after two prior lines of therapy with follicular, and we're giving them CAR T cells. And I think there are at least one or two other follicular relapsed studies with CAR T cells. So not a lot of clinical data that's been published yet in that one paper from Steve Schuster, but there are several ongoing studies to look at CAR T cells for relapsed follicular, especially these folks that relapse early after treatment.
Do you know anything about, I mean, I kind of had the feeling it wasn't as exciting as what you're seeing with diffuse large B cell, where in this case here, the patient progressed not that long after the CAR T. Any sense of just globally how this is going to land for follicular?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we don't know yet. So with follicular lymphoma, I think there's kind of two ways to think about how CAR T cells will fit. If it's a curative regimen in the majority of patients, then that's a big deal, right? I mean, the only thing that really cures patients reliably with follicular lymphoma is allotransplant. And unfortunately, allotransplant is associated with toxicity, meaning the odds of death from a transplant in follicular lymphoma around 15%. So this is not something that I want to send all my patients to unless I'm really worried about them dying of their disease. So if we can cure a large fraction of patients with follicular lymphoma without a lot of toxicity, I think that this is a really exciting option for people and maybe even in earlier lines of therapy.
But do you have that sense that it has that efficacy?
I don't know that. I can tell you there was another case I think that I had sent you about a 39-year-old woman who I had seen had also been through three or four lines of therapy for follicular lymphoma, including CHOP and, I can't remember, I think bendamustine, but at least two or three other chemotherapy regimens, and had actually flown in to see me because of this clinical trial that we have ongoing in follicular lymphoma, 39 years old, two young children.
Yeah, I see here she relapsed 9 months after auto transplant.
Yeah, and she went on to CAR T cell study in follicular, complete remission. Now, she's still earlier in follow-up, but we had not been able to achieve complete remission with anything else, really, including autotransplant. And so if it's true that these CAR T cells can salvage your unsalvageable patients, that's really something. Because there is, although it's a minority, a small minority of patients, we still have these patients in follicular lymphoma that relapse early or become refractory to even aggressive approaches. So I guess these two populations I see would be either patients that are failing everything else, including, for example, auto, or potentially, if the CR rate is high enough, earlier lines, second and third line regimens. But I think we don't yet know how this is going to pan out. It really depends on where the CR rate lands with follicular. In other words, where it lands in the setting of treatments.
So I've got to ask you, theoretically, what would you expect would be the effect of lenalidomide in the face of CAR T? Has that been looked at, speculated about? Should it be helpful?
Potentially. We know that, again, this does have an effect on T cells. John Gribben has done some work with lenalidomide in CLL and follicular lymphoma, and he's been able to show that lenalidomide can impair T cell recognition of certain antigens. So whether that's acting through T regulatory cells or cytotoxic T cells, I think it's kind of, we're still learning about that. But if lenalidomide can boost the effect of T cells, it would make sense that you might want to use this with a T cell directed therapy like CAR T cells. The flip side of that, right, is that there's the potential that you could increase toxicity, increase cytokine release, increase neurotoxicity with something like lenalidomide with CAR T. So right now, a lot of us are treading very carefully. I don't know of any trials ongoing where we're combining CAR T cells with lenalidomide. I think there wouldn't be a stretch to think about maybe using something like lenalidomide in patients who fail CAR T.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Or, yeah, just like your patient.
Yep. I mean, yeah, I think it'd be a great thing to try and CAR T. In fact, we're kind of doing this in a couple patients off protocol.
Wow, interesting.
But I would be a little bit hesitant to combine this in clinical trials yet until we kind of figure out more about the toxicity, how to manage toxicity with CAR T cells.
One other issue about this patient that was a part of her history prior to getting CAR T was she got adalimumab. We were talking about that before as another novel agent and seemed to do pretty well. She responded. And, you know, maybe you can just talk a little bit about what we know about response to adalimumab and particularly the issue of toxicity. You know, she really didn't have any problems, but as you alluded to, there have been these maybe delayed autoimmune kinds of effects. Can you kind of go through that?
Sure. So adalimumab lots of the PI3 kinase inhibitors, they do work. They work in patients who are failing chemotherapy, failing rituximab. In fact, a lot of the, you know, the registration trials for a lot of these drugs specifically looked at patients who had failed prior therapy, especially rituximab and chemotherapy. The IDEL is a registration trial. You had to be refractory to chemo and rituximab. And despite that, you got a response rate around 50 to 60%. So it clearly works in these patients where other things are not working. The problem is that it's not game-changing. So I think in a patient, especially in a young patient, these drugs are not curative, and you've got response rates on the average of around a year. So it works in patients that are relapsing, but unfortunately works, you know, most patients are not going to get a remission longer than a year or two. And the drugs are associated with some toxicity. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to predict who gets the toxicity, who doesn't. As you said, these toxicities can occur late, sometimes 3, 6, 9 months after a patient starts the drug. And many times they're immune mediated. And that can be things like colitis, pneumonitis, sometimes hepatitis, although hepatitis tends to occur a little earlier, usually in the first month. But they can be severe. And unfortunately, at least so far, they're unpredictable when they happen and who they happen in.
Globally, what's your estimate on the likelihood that some kind of clinically significant autoimmune event will occur?
Well, if you look at the rate of, let's say, colitis, in drugs like Adalimumab, that's somewhere probably on the order of 10 to 25%. So not the majority of patients, maybe 1 in 5 will get some colitis at some point. In many patients, if you stop the drug, and sometimes we even give a little steroids and restart the drug, it won't recur. In some of the other PI3 kinase inhibitors, drugs like copanolizib and other drugs that are currently in development, like umbralizib, the severe colitis rate appears to be significantly less, and that's still kind of being evaluated, but maybe 5%, not really higher than 10% in most of these other PI3 kinase inhibitors.
What about sort of quality of life side effect issues? It sounds like your lady didn't have any.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. In the absence of these atypical side effects, meaning colitis, pneumonitis. A lot of patients have no side effects with these PI3 kinase inhibitors. So in between having these events, many patients tolerate these very well. They don't really cause much nausea or fatigue or rash or hair loss. So in the patients that tolerate them well, they actually tolerate them great. And many patients can go on these drugs for sometimes years without having a lot of adverse events.
What about copanolizib? That now is also approved for follicular lymphoma. How does it contrast? And I see you have a 73-year-old lady who received the drug. How does it contrast in terms of efficacy and sort of the side effect spectrum? You mentioned less autoimmune problems, but we've been hearing about hyperglycemia, which I see your patient had.
Yeah. So this, again, was a woman. She was a little bit older, 73 years old, and she actually had a cardiac history. And I guess she'd been diagnosed about 4 or 5 years ago. I'm just looking at the case here. And I gave her bendamustine rituximab, and then she progressed about a couple years later. And then I gave her rituximab as a single agent. And again, I think this is a great option for patients, especially if they're older. They have an okay remission. Rituximab as a single agent is actually a nice thing to explore in the relapse setting. And we put her on then rituximab maintenance. Unfortunately, she progressed on maintenance therapy. And this is not a patient that really would tolerate an autologous or an allogeneic transplant. And so I put her on copanolizib, and she did very well. Her sugars went up to around the 200s, but they quickly went down within several hours of getting the drug. So we didn't have to intervene with any, you know, insulin or hyperglycemic medications. She actually did, she got 7 months later, but then progressed, yeah.
Right. And how often, the drug's given an IV, right?
It is given IV weekly. And so this sometimes can be a challenge. This woman is local, and so it's really not too much of an issue to come in and get her drugs. We have kind of an infusion center set up at MD Anderson where she comes in and gets the infusion and then goes home.
And what situations are you using PI3 kinase inhibitors, and how do you decide between these two?
Well, because we have a lot of clinical trials at Anderson, a lot of our patients, you know, will go on to a clinical trial. And we have clinical trials with PI3 kinase inhibitors. So I'll tell you, in my own practice, it's just kind of a small population to end up going on standard of care, PI3 kinase inhibitors. The kind of general patient that I think about for this kind of drug, whether that's idelalisib or copanolizib, will be someone that's failing rituximab. That's the first thing. And really either has failed a chemotherapy in fairly short order or won't tolerate it. And so these are kind of patients that are a little bit older, I'm looking for a milder option, and they're failing rituximab. Because this is the patient that, if they don't have a great performance status or other comorbid conditions, I usually give them single-agent rituximab, and many times I can get a lot of mileage out of that. But if that stops working, then I'm looking at something else that's fairly mild. And I think, really, the PI3 kinase inhibitors in most patients are very mild and well-tolerated.
And how do you decide between the two?
So, for example, in an older patient, I probably would pick copanolisib first. The diarrhea can be severe if it occurs. Unfortunately, it's still unpredictable. We don't have a good biomarker to tell me who it's going to happen in. And I have had a couple patients in the early idelalisib trials that actually were admitted to the ICU. I mean, this is not diarrhea like you've had a bad meal and you get a little bit of loose stools. We've had patients actually become hypotensive on pressors because they're having diarrhea 10, 20 times a day, become dehydrated, get admitted to the ER. And so in a 70-year-old patient, that could be potentially life-threatening. So I think in older patients that don't have an issue with traveling back and forth to the center for IV infusions, I probably would pick copanolisib. In a patient, again, I'm in Texas, maybe that's in the rural community, live several hours from MD Anderson, where IV is going to be a challenge, then I would probably pick the oral drug. So it's, I guess it's more really about logistics and just really warn them about side effects, tell them to stop the drug immediately if they have a significant diarrhea, and we try to stay on top of it remotely.
You mentioned the hyperglycemia with copanolisib. How often does that require either oral agents or insulin?
Almost never. I mean, if you look at the early trials, I want to say it was, you know, 10% or less. Patients can get sugars that go all the way up to the 400s, and as long as they're asymptomatic, they usually can be watched. I mean, in my own practice, if they get a blood glucose that high, I often will bring them back the following morning, give them some education about things to look for with regards to hyperglycemia. But I don't think there's, if I remember right from this trials, I don't think we had any episodes of DKA or any serious side effects from the hyperglycemia.
And is it a continuous thing or just when they get the infusion?
No, just when they get the drug. And then usually the blood glucose will spike soon thereafter. But literally by the next day, I don't think I've ever seen anybody where it persists more than a day.
That's really interesting. One other thing I was going to ask you, and I want to get to your last case. Just want to sort of divert out and just bring up an issue that I'm just kind of curious about what your thoughts are, which is the patient with FL and early relapse and how you define early relapse, what it means in terms of prognosis, and how you manage patients like that.
Patients that are progressing early, I think the very first thing that you need to do is re-biopsy the patient.
Well, first of all, how would you define early?
2 years.
2 years from diagnosis or end of treatment?
2 years from the initiation of treatment. So some patients will get diagnosed and get watched for 2 years. So once they start treatment, they progress within 2 years. So I guess 18 months from the finishing treatment.
Right.
Those patients, and, you know, we've seen the data now that these patients tend to do well. But I think as oncologists, this is not too much of a surprise. You know, patients that have early relapse with any disease, we're in trouble. And so, you know, I think the patients that progress within 2 years of therapy with R-CHOP, I usually will do bendamustine. I think there's pretty good data that bendamustine is different enough from Cytoxan that I usually give them another opportunity to have a long remission. If they relapse again early, so 2 relapses within 2 years of initiation of therapy, that's when these are the patients I'm looking for, things like autotransplant, allotransplant, et cetera. But I usually, for example, if a patient progresses the first time within 2 years of BR or R-CHOP, I don't automatically go to transplant or something more aggressive. Usually I'll try to one alternate regimen with a biopsy to make sure they're not transforming.
Okay, well, let's finish out and hear about your 43-year-old man.
So this is a 43-year-old patient, and he's actually interesting. He's from Georgia, owns a local business there in Georgia, and works out all the time, very, very healthy, and happened to notice that he was getting some lymph nodes in the neck and in the armpit, and went and saw his local doctor. They biopsied it, and it was a grade 3A follicular lymphoma. And then he came to Houston. I saw him. We did some PET imaging. And actually, he had quite a bit of nodes. And frankly, I think because he was just so healthy, he didn't notice that he was kind of developing adenopathy in other places. He actually had a node in the abdomen, which is around 7 or 8 centimeters, and was otherwise fairly asymptomatic. SUV on the PET scan was all fairly low, 5 or 6. And no elevated LDH, no B symptoms. And so at that time, we kind of talked about what the next step was. And these kind of patients are always a challenge. He's a 3A. And so in my practice, I think of 3A as kind of straddling the fence between an aggressive and a low-grade lymphoma. And when I have a 3A, I often let the other clinical and diagnostic criteria, I let that guide me on which way to go. So, for example, if a patient has a 3A follicular lymphoma and they have a high LDH and a lot of symptoms and the PET scan is hot, I'll treat them as an aggressive lymphoma. If they have a 3A and the Ki-67 is low, low LDH, and small lymph nodes, then I treat them as a grade 1-2 follicular, like with something like bendamustine rituximab. With this gentleman, because he was fairly young, because he had a fairly bulky disease in the abdomen, I decided to treat him more as an aggressive lymphoma, and we gave him R-CHOP. He tolerated R-CHOP great, window complete remission. And then I was following him initially fairly closely to make sure, again, this was not a large cell lymphoma relapsing. And eventually I just started seeing him about once a year in follow-up. I want to say 4 or 5 years later, he progressed. I biopsied it again. And again, he had several nodes kind of scattered above and below the diaphragm, PET lit up, but all low SUVs. And again, 3A follicular. And this was, again, a bit of a challenge when thinking about what to do next, right? So is this a guy that has large cell lymphoma that's relapsing again? In that case, he should go to autotransplant. Or is this a low-grade lymphoma that's progressed after R-CHOP? And we talked about it quite a while, and this guy is so healthy. And I thought, this is a great guy that if he does have a good immunologic response, maybe he'd be good with lenalidomide rituximab. And so we put him on, I think it was either lenalidomide rituximab or obinutuzumab, lenalidomide obinutuzumab, as part of the clinical trials, and boom, he went into complete remission by the third cycle. And he's still in a complete remission, still early, but had a really great response. In fact, all the bulky nodes have now disappeared. So, you know, could we have handled this some other way? Possibly. We probably could have done bendamustine rituximab. This is probably what I would have done outside of a clinical trial. But I probably would not have sent this guy to auto transplant because of the long duration of first response. So if it was transformed, it's a little unusual to transform that far out if he had occult transformation. But hopefully he does well, and he's just finishing treatment.
If you were to see a patient like this at initial presentation again, I'm sure you do see patients like this. Do you think, you mentioned, you know, how you kind of decide whether to use R-CHOP or BR. What about R-squared?
Yeah, so I think that the one scenario where I would not use R-squared is in patients where I'm worried about transformation. This guy is right on the fence. So in his initial presentation, because he had kind of bulky disease and it's hard because he's so healthy, one of the difficult things with young patients is they tend to tolerate more disease burden before they have symptoms, meaning could he have had some occult transformation, just not know it because he's so healthy. Maybe. So in this case, I think I probably should have done R-CHOP. But let's say he had presented with 3A disease, had found a little solitary node. We did scans, and he just had a couple, you know, small nodes around, and maybe he's developing a little B symptoms. Then I would definitely consider lenalidomide rituximab in the absence of any gestalt that something might be transforming.
So you were part of the meeting we did recently, the Pan-Pacific meeting in Maui. 2 hours we talk about follicular lymphoma, but as you know, we had done a survey of 30 lymphoma investigators that led into that meeting, and I was just looking at how they responded to this case, which is 60-year-old patient, 3A disease, stage 4, bulky tumor, symptomatic. And you know, our version of consensus conferences or guidelines is to say what people do. So here's what they did. Bendamustine or bendamustine 11, R-CHOP 11,
yeah,
O-CHOP 1, and O-BENDA 1. But anyhow, it gives you a little granularity of how people are thinking through this issue. Any thoughts?
No, I mean, I think that case, what you just described, actually sounds a lot like this guy, although he didn't have symptoms. I would have been on with the R-CHOP 11, so maybe make that 12 versus 11 now.
Right. Just to finish up, anything new on management of transformed disease?
Right now, no. I think that it'd be interesting to see how CAR T cells play out for transformed. I think that they...
You would think so.
Yeah, I think they're definitely going to be a player in transformed lymphomas. One thing I think that we're doing now that we really weren't doing so much of a couple years ago is checking for MYC. We know that a lot of these transformed, unfortunately, could be a double hits. And so one thing I do now, which you know I really didn't do as much of a couple years ago, every single transformed lymphoma patient should have MYC testing, absolutely, because that will change your management, right? If you just have a general patient that progresses with transformation after BR, I would do R-CHOP, versus they really should be considered for R-EPOC or auto if they've got a double hit.
So another two-hour meeting we did down there in Maui is on CLL. One of the things I was hearing there that I thought was really interesting was the issue of checkpoint inhibitors in transformed CLL, which I guess there looks like there's some efficacy, but not in transformed FL.
So right now, I hope that we can figure out checkpoints in low-grade. Right now, the data with checkpoint inhibitors in low-grade lymphomas, like follicular, there was an abstract that was presented at the recent ASCO, 9% response rate. Not that great in follicular. I have not seen any data with transformed follicular with checkpoint inhibitors, but at least in the non-transformed follicular setting as a single agent, has not been all that exciting. We do have some trials ongoing at Anderson where we're combining checkpoints with rituximab, and there are some ongoing trials where they're looking at checkpoints with lenalidomide in follicular. But it's a single agent, not at least I don't know if there's a huge future for these drugs in follicular. Again, transformed disease, no data yet.